everybody. This is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
And we're here for the Invested podcast. And I'm so glad to be back. Yay!
You're back! Yay! Dad, I missed you.
Oh, I missed doing this with you too. I've just been off for a little while, and I'm excited to get cranking on this again because we just had a really good workshop for 3 days in Birmingham, Alabama. First time we ever went to Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, is that your rule on workshops that you do, the weekend, like 3 day weekend workshops?
Yep. And as soon as I say Alabama, I kind of want to do that thing from Forrest Gump, you know?
Oh, dear.
I can't remember what he was saying about Alabama. He's from someplace in Alabama. When he gets in that fight with that hippie, and he says, I'll be in Greenbow, Alabama, or something like that. Anyway, it was really cute. Tom Hanks is such a good actor.
I love him. That movie was on TV the other day, and I hadn't seen it in years. And I just watched like 10 minutes of it, and all I thought was, God, this really holds up. It's really a good movie.
It really holds up well. It does. I feel like I've got a little Forrest Gump in me, to tell you the truth.
I think you do, actually. Really? You've had not just 9 lives, you've had about 30 different lives.
But I totally relate to that whole scene where he's back, he's in the military, and he's back from Vietnam, and he's part of that peace demonstration, and he's part of this Black Panther party, and you know, the whole sequence there.
I haven't seen it in so long.
That brought it all back to me in a big way, because I was for a period of time I was was involved in both sides of this thing, and it was just, oh man, crazy time back in the 60s and early 70s, that's for sure.
I think when you get like ultra old and you're confined to a chair and you just have people like bring you what you want, I think that your brain will still work totally well and you should write your memoirs.
I think they'd be really, really boring unless I could figure out a way to write them really in an interesting way, because memoirs are generally pretty boring reads.
They are not.
You don't think
you
they are?
You and I both read memoirs like crazy.
What are we talking about? I guess I love autobiographies. Is that a memoir?
Yes.
Oh, okay, good. Well, then there we go.
It's just a fancier word.
I like autobiography better. Memoir sounds like some old fart sitting on a couch talking in a most boring terms about something that he experienced.
Whereas autobiography somehow sounds amazingly fascinating
to you.
Yeah,
it's like, really like those.
Well, I think it entirely depends on the subject matter, and I think you've got it.
Speaking of autobiographical work here, on this podcast, we are breaking down the investing process of the best investors in the world who are all in the same camp that the world considers to be value investing, but which I call Rule One investing.
Ah.
Yeah, I think there's a difference there. Value investing is the idea of trying to buy something cheaper than what it's worth. Is the idea, right? Mm-hmm. And Rule One investing is focusing not so much on cheaper than it's worth as don't lose money, which is rule number one, right? Now, those
which
two things go hand in hand.
Me now for many, many hours, many, many episodes.
Yep.
And a couple of years.
And it's a lovely thing, actually. This I love what you've introduced to me. This thing you've introduced to me is this idea of a practice that I've never thought about my investing before in terms of a practice. You know, I tend to be kind of goal oriented, right? And like, okay, now we got it. But a practice says that you're never going to got it, right? You're never going to be there. It's always a work in progress. And certainly you'll go through the phases of not knowing anything and then becoming somewhat, decent at what you're doing and ultimately become a master at what you're doing.
And that the joy is in the journey of going through those.
The joy is in the journey. And I love that idea because investing is so often thought about as something you have to go through to get to something, you know, a certain amount of money, a certain lifestyle.
And that's exactly why people like me don't do it, because of that, because it's this goal out there and we're busy and we're doing other stuff. and we don't really want to deal with it. And so going through the process that's only to get to a goal doesn't sound like a great use of time.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, if you're struggling to get to this thing, right? As you're digging this ditch to get to this goal
exactly.
of having a ditch dug or
exactly.
something, right? But I think, you know, we look at the people who we're emulating and who we're talking about in this podcast, particularly Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger. But in general, the value investors that we know, I think you'd have to argue are pretty happy people. I mean, pretty
yeah.
interesting people who are really engaged in the world on a different level than a lot of people are. And I think that comes in part from, well, I think Charlie talks about it a really different kind of way. He basically says that, you know, every great investor he's ever met just reads a lot about mm-hmm. everything, reads everything. And it all sort of stews around in your brain and feeds into your view that, hey, this is something that's really valuable and it's underpriced. It's been mispriced in the market for some reason. And you try to understand the reason it's been mispriced. And if you like the reason, if it's a good reason to invest in something that's been mispriced for a short period of time, then you jump in at it. But it's the process of really understanding the world that's so fascinating that Charlie is so into, right?
It is. It yeah. is. And what we want to talk about starting today is this incredible interview that came out about a month ago, but with Monish Pabrai, who's a Rule Number One style investor. And he gave an interview to Forbes Online. Now, before we do that, first of all, I'm telling you guys the interview because you should all go find it and read it. I tweeted it. I put it on Facebook. This interview is, I put it in my monthly newsletter. Like, this interview is worth reading and we're going to talk about it.
Yeah, but I'll put it out to all of our students and have them all take a look at it too. So it's really valuable.
If you look up like Forbes Monish Pabrai, it'll come up. It came out on June 25th, 2018. But before we start our discussion, Dad, I just have a little bit of housekeeping. First of all, guys, as you know, last week we started our first ever inaugural Invested Book Club with Investing Between the Lines by L.J. Rittenhouse. And I'm so excited about this book. So on August 14th, on our episode on August 14th, we're going to play my entire interview with the author, all about this book and how she evaluates companies using words, not so much numbers, which to me like blew my mind. So pick up that book, check it out. That will be our August 14th episode. Now that I've said that, let me add one more thing. We also promised to talk about owner earnings that we put in our book, Invested. And we are going to get to that, you guys, but it's a big subject and we need a little prep and we need to make sure we have a good amount of time to chat about it and really understand how to get into these numbers. So we're going to put that off for a little bit later, but it's coming. I promise. It's on our mind.
Yep.
Right, Dad?
And yep, that's what we're going to do. Owner earnings is fascinating. It's a concept that Warren Buffett created. As far as I know, nobody else really uses that term. Warren and Charlie use it. They have a rather subjective way of coming out to the numbers that makes it not really, you know, crystal clean about how you're going to end up with a number. And we'll get all into that and why we like to use it.
Yeah. So there's a lot to talk about and I want to make sure we have the time and the focus to really make a strong series. Cause as you guys know, this is why we wrote our book Invested, because we talked about this stuff on the podcast and it's hard to really make it clear in a purely audio format. So now that we have the book, we can refer to it easily and you guys can all refer to it easily. And then we can really talk about it much, much more clearly.
And so by the way, of course, we dive deep into the concepts of owner earnings, free cash flow, payback time, all of these concepts of valuing businesses deeply in our 3-day workshop. And I'm going to make an unembarrassed plug here that... that the Invested book is an incredible workbook for the 3-day workshop. And the podcast here, this Invested podcast, is sending more and more people to the workshop all the time. So if you decide to come, you're going to be there with a relatively large number of people who have been big fans of this podcast and have listened to every single one of them, some of them a couple of times.
That's true.
And they come so prepared, Danielle. There were a big bunch of them in Birmingham. And
cool.
They're so prepared. I mean, they've really studied, and it's phenomenal to see what they can do in 3 days because wow. they come ready.
So, well, as long as we're plugging the workshop, Dad, I am going to be at your October workshop. I don't go to them all that often. This is exciting. So just so you all know, podcast listeners, I will be at the October one, and I would love to meet you and have pictures and sign books and chat. And
we might even do a podcast broadcast right out of there live.
You know, I think we should. I've been thinking about that, and I just have not, the audio logistics of it are a little difficult. So we need to do that. That would be a great idea. I love it.
We'll get my team on it and see if they can come up with something that'll work.
All right, cool. So that's all of our housekeeping. Let's move on to this amazing interview. And I'm so glad that you led into it by talking about practicing, because to me, this interview is about how Monish Pabrai practices investing. Mm-hmm. He talks a little bit about specific investments, a tiny bit, but really he just talks about how he approaches value investing. I just love the way he talks about it. He sort of like touches on it very lightly. Like he's just like keeping it simple.
Well, let me introduce Monish just briefly. We've talked about him on the podcast before, but, and you'll see a good bio, sorry, you'll see a good bio in the Forbes article. And I just real briefly tell you that he's from India, came to Clemson in the 1980s. He's got a degree as an engineer, did IT work, formed his own small company, and then eventually sold it. And after selling his company, he read Roger Lowenstein's book, Buffett, The Making of an American Capitalist. And he was so taken with it that he started diving into the next level, which was to read every single one of Warren Buffett's letters to his shareholders. And he got hooked from there. And he is an extremely good teacher about investing. I really like his book. His book is called The Dondo Investor, which is award-winning, and speaks about investing in terms of buying businesses, public companies.
Yeah, he lays out his strategy of investing in The Dondo Investor.
Yep. And Mosaic, Perspectives on Investing, which is a series of kind of essay-like things that he goes into on investing, which are really good. And you should read those books. I mean, those are things to add to the library, along with Lowenstein's book. And we've gotten to know Monish a little bit just from attending Charlie Munger's annual meeting. And it was really cute. At Munger's meeting this last year, he had Monish actually stand up to be applauded by the audience for insisting on a really ethical structure to his fund, which is copying Warren's structure, which is to not charge fees and to put a minimum rate of return per year before he starts to take his participation in profits. What Charlie asked him to do is stand up and receive some applause for really putting the investors first by not charging a fee, not skimming off the top, which I think is really pretty cool. And
I think it's incredible. And I actually wasn't really going to touch on that in this discussion because it doesn't really matter to those of us learning about investing so that we can do it ourselves. But I find it absolutely fascinating, this distinction between investors who manage other people's money, who choose to at least attempt or achieve this zero management fee. Management fee.
Right.
I was debating management fee or what's the other kind of fee called where you take
participation fee.
Thank you. So what that means is they don't charge any money off the top, as Dad said, but what they do then is take a larger percentage of any money they make for you. So everyone's incentives are aligned, which is beautiful.
It is. And what's really extraordinary, I think, is that the only people who get the benefit of this kind of Monish Pabrai fee structure or Warren Buffett free structure, where you're not charging fees, you only charge if you make people money. The only people that can benefit from that are wealthy people. The Securities Exchange Commission in their wisdom from 1937 or something, determined that if you were to run a fund where individuals can invest who are not wealthy, that would be a sort of a mutual fund structure, a public mutual fund, you're not allowed to take participation in the profits. Right. People don't realize that. They're mutual fund managers who are the only funds that are available to be actively managed for people who are not wealthy are not allowed to participate in the profits. They must charge a fee. And the reason the SEC did that is, at least their logic is, that if you allow a fund manager to participate in the profits, you incentivize him to take risk.
Right. That's the point. They were trying to protect against risk-taking and create a situation in which the manager is kind of a benevolent ruler who is making the decisions simply to make money but not actually focus on themselves. And it doesn't work. Like, it makes no sense. Even as I'm saying it, it makes no sense.
It does make sense if you invest with somebody who's not moral, who is unethical, who has low integrity, then absolutely they could just take a shot because they don't get paid. There's no fee.
No, but what it does, and you've said this a million times on here, what it does that drives me nuts is that what it creates is the incentive to simply bring in more money because you get paid based on a fee across the amount of money that you manage. So if you manage more rather than less, you get paid more rather than less.
Not how you do.
Not how you do.
Nothing now, to do with how you do.
Yeah. So like assuming that people take their money out if you do badly, okay, that's a check on you. But that's going to take a while for that to happen.
Oh, well, it's incentivized fund managers to be very cautious and to just kind of stay with the market. And probably 95% of the people who are managing money are, in essence, shadowing the stock market rate of return, knowing that if they can do slightly better, not a lot better, like Buffett or Monash, but a little bit, but it's a little bit, half a point better.
So then, Monash...
Then the money stays with them and they get paid based on assets under management. They get a percentage, a management fee, typically in the range of 1-3% for the assets under management. So all they do, as you say, is just accumulate assets under management and try to hold on to it rather than trying to do a really good ethical job of managing money. And that's a really a terrible irony, is that the people who need the best managers in the world are not getting them.
Well, I'll tell you another one, which I read this interview with Monish Pabrai and had never thought about this really, about hedge fund managers actually taking zero management fees as a concept. And I was fascinated and I started reading everything I could find about how people do that. Because I thought, why doesn't everybody do that? This is so obvious, even as just a marketing tool. And I'll tell you why. It's really hard to run a fund without having any management fees because funds are expensive to run. You got to pay yourself. You got to pay people to work for you. You got to pay a lot of startup costs. You have to pay lawyers. You have to pay, what are the people called who do all the accounting?
Administrative people. The administration.
Okay, there you go. The administration. They have like some fancier role than what it sounds like, but yes, the administration. Yep. There's all these things. There's all these costs, just like running any business would have costs. And so what this means is that Monish Pabrai pays for all of those costs essentially out of his own pocket, thanks to his structure. Now, he can afford to do that because he's been going for quite a while, a number of years. He's done well for quite a number of years. So for him, it's fine. But for somebody starting up a fund, it's really hard to do this unless you come from family money. I actually read a whole white paper about how you can set up a zero management fee fund. And it essentially concluded, if you have money, then you can do it as long as you can like manage to live for 2-3 years without getting paid and you can front all of your startup costs and admin costs, then you can do it. And by then you should assuming you're good at what you do, you should make enough money to where then the fund will pay for itself.
Yep.
But it's hard. So it was really good education for me to understand why people in real life, in real business, may want to do it like this, but aren't able to.
Yeah. And I think that the vast majority of people who are investing money for other people are pretty much modern portfolio theory investors. They don't really think you can beat the market for any long period of time. And they prove that out by their funds not beating the market for any long period of time. And so it's really in their best interest to charge a fee. And otherwise, they probably just wouldn't even do it. Whereas you got guys like Monash and Warren and Charlie and Guy Spear and really, really good investors who are coming into it with some money to start with. Although I got to say, Buffett didn't come into it with money to start with. He started with $100 and made his first group of people, I think $100,000 was his first partnership. And he did that basically with no fee and pretty quickly started to make money right away. And that kind of
He charged some sort of management. I kind of want to pull. I'm reading that book out now.
I don't think so. Maybe I'm wrong.
There was a small one. I got to look it up. I'll look it up and I'll report.
Okay, good.
Interesting, this book is fascinating. Lowenstein's biography of Buffett. And I highly recommend that should be in our invested book club next. If I can get him to come on our podcast, because that's the rule, Dad. Nobody's book except they come on the podcast.
All right, good.
I'm going to quickly regret that rule. But what I thought was so fascinating was his shift. Now we're moving on to Buffett. Buffett's shift from his partnership structure to his corporate structure with Berkshire Hathaway was, in my opinion, I think there are two reasons. One was he didn't think he could make any money in the market for a number of years. So he just literally got out. And when you're in a fund like that and you're running it and you're managing people's money, that doesn't work too well. And secondly, I think he just didn't want to have any sort of fees. It was just either you're in or you're out. You buy a share of stock or you don't. Like, those are the options. Very simple.
I think there was one more reason.
Tell me.
He's never talked about this. This is just my guess, is that he had 5 or 6 partnerships by that time. And quite a millions and millions of dollars under management. He had been doing 30% plus rates of return for many years. And I think at some point he got tired of people questioning his judgment about staying in a stock or not staying in a stock or leaving your money in cash. And it starts to wear on investment managers after a while, the demand of people for constantly improving rates of return. And I think that, you know, when you're delivering 30% and people are still leaving your fund or asking for redemptions or thinking you haven't done well if you have a year where you don't do 30%, it must be frustrating that your own investors simply don't understand the investing method that you're using. In spite of all these letters you've written, in spite of trying to teach them, they still don't understand. And I've seen that at the Berkshire meetings where in 2008, Buffett said very clearly he hoped that the stocks that he owns in Berkshire would go down in this recession of 2008. He said he hoped they would go down 50%.
I remember when you told me that on this podcast, I could not comprehend why anyone would want that.
Right. But now?
But now I'm like, oh yeah, of course.
All right. You have drunk the Kool-Aid.
I know. I was just thinking that.
You really know you've drunk the Rule 1 Kool-Aid when you really look forward to your own stocks going down. I mean, that is so counterintuitive to the 99% of investors out there. They just simply can't grasp why anybody would want that to happen. And that, of course, was the case with all of these people in the audience in 2008. There was an audible moan in the crowd from Buffett saying that, because it would mean that Berkshire's stock would go down. And these people who are watching this master invest have been investors for years, still did not understand the basic concepts of investing.
Dad, why would Buffett want those stocks to go down?
So that he can take the cash he has and buy lots more of them with companies he already knows a lot about, doesn't have to do the research, and buys them on sale. And this ultimately would be the idea of consuming things, right? We talked about this like a couple of years ago, I think maybe, is that if you were consuming hamburgers, you loved hamburgers, do you want the price of hamburgers to go up or down if you know you're going to be consuming hamburgers into the future? And Buffett's point is you should want the price of hamburgers to go down. And he said, I am a consumer of stocks. I'm a buyer. I'm not a seller. And so if I'm a buyer, I want these companies to go on sale over and over again so that I can buy them cheaper and cheaper. And that really does make sense if you're a consumer over the long term. And that would mean you're having some form of capital coming in from the outside, right? You're not stuck with a single amount of money that you've got to make
yes.
money on.
Yes.
You've got money coming in. And in payback time, I talked about it in the form of a Berkey, like basically a cute term for Berkshire Hathaway being a company which flows cash flow, owner earnings, flowing into Warren Buffett to reinvest every year. And I mean, it gets to be quite a pile of money coming in the form of cash flow. So here's Buffett right now, for example, with over $100 billion that's come in from just pure cash flow from all these companies he owns. And so his point is well taken. If you have, let's say you're making money in a job and you're saving 10% of your money every year, then that would mean every year you've got more capital to invest and you want to buy stuff cheap. So yeah, you want stuff to go down. And it's very non-intuitive.
It's super non-intuitive. And I think the point that you need to have additional funds to invest is the key point there. Because I think the people who are going, oh no, are probably just thinking like, we have a set amount of money. It's all invested in Berkshire Hathaway. We can't put any more in. And they don't remember that Buffett in the company has quite a lot of cash that he wants to deploy.
Right. And this makes a big difference, right? If you're retired, you don't have any money coming in, then I would say probably you pretty much don't want stock prices to go down. after you've invested all of your capital, you want to buy in a kind of 2009 recession, stock market crash, and everything's down 50%. You want to load up the truck with all of your retirement capital right there. You want to be very aggressive, and then you want to just sit there and reap the rewards, right? Through great rates of return from dividends and from these companies going up in capital appreciation. So
it's
that's
a really
the basic
interesting
idea.
Point that you're making without, I'll just call it out because you're not totally saying it. Like, there may be different investing strategies in different periods of your life, in different financial situations. I mean, I know I've heard you say a number of times, like how I shouldn't be afraid of investing because nobody's shooting at me. So how scary can it be? Or as I'm completely...
Easy for me to say, right?
Yeah, I'm completely generally freaked out. But your point is that when you're young, it's not the end of the world if you lose all your money. You know, like, let's say I lose all my money. Okay, I'm going to pick myself up and have a lot of years left to make that money back and do a better job. Whereas if I were 75, that would not be true.
Right. But I think the investment concepts should be exactly the same, to tell you the truth. I don't think that you should change your view and try to do more aggressive investments when you're young and more conservative investments when you're old. I think that is the sort of the general strategy of modern portfolio theory financial advisors. But I think in the real world of value investing, you want the same strategy all the time. You want to be looking for wonderful businesses that are on sale. The difference is going to be whether you just sit there with them for the rest of your life.
Yeah. That's a much better way to say it.
So you would sell them as you're young. You would as this company will come up into a certain range of intrinsic value, like you buy it on sale 50% off and it doubles and now it's back at intrinsic value, then you'll make a judgment whether the future growth rate of this company will continue to be so significant that you want to hang on to it or not. And if it's not going to be that significant, then you maybe want to, and if you have other places to put the money, then you want to move out of that and move to something new.
What I find interesting in this Monish Pabrai interview is that he says he actually doesn't own any U.S. companies at all right now.
Which should we dive into this eventually here, or should we start a new podcast for next week?
You guys, but I just thought it was such a like apropos thing to move to because we're talking about Pabrai and Buffett and the way they're different, and Buffett has said many times that he thinks the U.S. is a great long-term bet. So yeah, I'm really interested in this.
Yep. And Monash is very clearly in this article saying he's not invested in anything in the U.S. and is pretty much like, let's talk about why, and let's dig into that next time. What do you say?
Okay. Sounds good. So check out this this interview. We'll talk about it more next time. Monish Pabrai on Forbes.com.
Download Lowenstein's Buffett. Lowenstein's Buffett, the Making American Capitalist.
Read Investing Between the Lines, and we'll be back next time with more about all this stuff.
All right. Until then,
thanks, everybody.
Time to go play. See you guys.
Bye.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information, show notes, and more episodes, visit us at investedpodcast.com. There's a special offer waiting for podcast listeners to attend my 3-day investing workshop absolutely free. So just head to investedpodcast.com. Everything discussed on this podcast is either my opinion or Danielle's opinion and is not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your investment advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I hope you enjoyed it.